Just in case there are some people that aren't here in lecture today, for the recording's sake, I wanted to remind everyone there is a quiz this Thursday. Later on in the lecture today, we'll be reviewing for the quiz, so I'll tell you the types of problems you can expect, the material that's going to be covered on the quiz. But I wanted to make it as far through Chapter 3 as we could first, because that will partly determine what's going to be on the quiz. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to start with Section 4. Not that the previous sections aren't interesting, it's just that we've got some trickier material that's at the end of the chapter. And I wanted to give a little bit of an explanation that's beyond what's in the textbook. Not to try to make it more difficult, but to try to come up with a fuller explanation specifically about quantum mechanics, one of the topics in the later of the chapter. Before we start with Chapter 3, though, did anybody have any questions from Chapter 1 or Chapter 2? Because how many of you have started reading to catch up with Chapter 1 and Chapter 2? So the rest of you, are you making the foolish mistake of assuming that my lectures are good enough? Because I know that maybe there's times where I say something in lecture that makes sense, but you're really going to get a better understanding if you do read through the text. So if you've chosen not to read the text because you're relying on the class notes, I really strongly encourage you to get into the text and read. If you just haven't gotten around to reading the text because you don't realize there's a quiz coming up on Thursday, and usually people tend to do a little bit better if you study for it. So as we go through the lecture today, if you have questions from past material that you do think of, let me know. But if you don't have any questions for now, I'm going to go ahead and dive into Chapter 3. So Chapter 3, we get more into atomic structure. And there are some experiments at the beginning of the chapter that I mentioned we're going to be skipping for now. But these are classic experiments that did help to identify some of the subatomic particles. The one experiment I did want to refer to quickly is the Rutherford gold foil experiment. So what that involved was a thin sheet of gold metal which was exposed to a form of radiation, specifically what are known as alpha particles. So there was some sort of source that released this set of particles that was aimed at the gold foil. We now know that alpha particles, just to put it out to the side here, are helium nucleus. So if you have helium without its surrounding electrons, that's going to be a positively charged species. We're going to get some terminology in this chapter. In fact, let me go ahead and write these out. One bit of terminology is an ion. Does anybody know what an ion is? Yes. No, it's something that could have extra or missing electrons, which means it's what?
Isn't that a charged
atom? It's some kind of charged particle. It could be a molecule. It doesn't necessarily have to be just an atom, but an ion is a charged particle. And they come in two flavors, cations and anions. So a cation is a positively charged ion. And an anion is a negatively charged. Ion. If we are talking about individual atoms, if you end up with a cation, it's because it's missing electrons. If you end up with an anion, it's because it has extra electrons. So along with this, I'll say that a neutral atom has an equal number of protons and electrons. Because remember that protons are the positively charged particles, electrons are negatively charged, and so if you have an equal number of them, you could say the charges cancel out, and you end up with a neutral or uncharged atom. So the reason I needed some of this terminology is because it comes up in this gold foil experiment. Helium nuclei, which is what makes up alpha particles, are cations. They're positively charged. And the beginning of the chapter, which is what we're skipping over a little bit, there was some understanding at the point that this experiment was done that there may be positive and negatively charged particles inside an atom. And here's what the results of the gold foil experiment give us, that most of the alpha particles just pass right through the gold foil. But every once in a while, there's one of those particles that gets bounced back. Now, if you thought that the atom had positive charge that was evenly spread all throughout the atom, then it would make sense that the particles would pass right through. In other words, if there's no core to the atom, there's nothing for these alpha particles to bounce off of. Well, why would they bounce off of something? Well, if they bumped into something else that was positively charged. So if you haven't had any form of physics before, you hopefully know that positive and negative charges, they attract each other. Whereas if you have two negative charges or two positive charges, they're going to repel each other. And so what the results of this experiment were thought to mean is, well, there must be some kind of point in the atom that is positively charged, which is why the alpha particles got deflected. So this is what led to the concept of there being a nucleus to the atom. So if I wanted to write out the results of this just briefly, in the gold foil experiment, alpha particles were shot into a thin foil of gold. Most of the particles passed straight through. But some alpha particles were deflected back. This was due to the positively charged alpha particles interacting with some positive charge located in the atom. And the results of this experiment led to the idea that there is a nucleus to the atom. Yes.
So why do they choose gold? Is it because gold tends to not react with a lot of stuff?
You know, that's a good question, which I'm not sure I know the answer to. Maybe they had determined it was a rather heavy atom. So if it was going to run into something, you might think that something more massive would present a better target. I'll see if I can find out why it was that it was gold that was chosen. Let me make a reminder for myself. So we've already talked a little bit about the nucleus itself, but I want to talk a little bit more specifically, because I know that I already brought up the term isotope because I discussed it the other day. But there's some terminology I didn't bring up yet. So there is what is known as the atomic number, which is abbreviated capital Z, which is equal to the number of protons in the nucleus. If you remember our discussion of elements, that elements are types of atoms that have a specific number of protons. So each atom, each type of atom, each element has its own atomic number. And so it's atomic number that we use to arrange the elements on the periodic table. There's something else that I might not have introduced before, which is the mass number. And that's equal to the total number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus. And I'll go ahead and repeat our definition of isotopes. So isotopes, to phrase it a little bit differently than maybe what I did before, are atoms with the same atomic number, which means the same number of protons, but different mass numbers. Which, if a mass number is the combination of protons and neutrons, and if we're keeping the number of protons the same because we're talking about the same type of atom, that means there's different number of neutrons. Now, we can write what's known as an atomic symbol. Which consists of the abbreviation of the element itself. So let's say that we have hydrogen, for example. And there's four different numbers that can go around this atomic symbol. One of them is the atomic number. Which, again, that's the number of protons. That's in the lower left-hand corner. In the upper left-hand corner, that's where we usually write the mass number. So that's the number of protons and neutrons. In most of the chemistry that you're going to be learning, we don't even write either of these numbers. Usually, if we're writing out chemical equations, we're just writing out the atomic abbreviations. But if we're talking about isotopes, then we specify which mass number that we have, and then optionally we can include the atomic number. The reason I say optionally is because as soon as you write out the element symbol, the abbreviation, then you've automatically got the same atomic number, because again, atomic number is what determines what kind of element that you've got. Now, in a more complete formula, there are two other numbers that you can put. So, since we now have talked about cations and anions, the way that we show that we have a cation or anion is to write a charge to the upper right-hand side of the symbol. And so that is the number of protons minus the number of electrons. So if you have the same number of protons and electrons, you don't end up with a charge on the atom. If you're missing some electrons, which means you've got more protons, then you're going to end up with a positive number. Now, some people always write numbers in, so they'll write plus one. A lot of people, though, if it's just a single charge, they'll leave the number one out. Some textbooks actually reverse the order. They'll write one plus or one minus to show that it's a form of charge. It's not some form of counting number. I usually just write it as plus or minus and then the number, and I usually leave the number one out. So if you had more electrons, though, than protons, that's how you would end up with a negative number. The last thing that might go on a symbol is what I call stoichiometry. That's a term we haven't really discussed at all yet, and it has to do with ratios. And to simplify the definition for now, it's the number of atoms. So, for example, in the formula H2O, which is water, the 2 indicates that you have 2 hydrogens, and so that's what the 2 here would represent as well. Now, in the chapter, it focuses just on the atomic number and mass number, but since we're already talking about atomic symbols, that's why I wanted to mention these other possible numbers. Now, going back to what's in the chapter, there's a specific set of isotopes that I want you to be familiar with. And these are the isotopes of hydrogen. Oh, question. Sorry, yes.
So how do you know when you express the mass number and the atomic number?
How do you know? I just chose a particular example. Oh, no, it's just literally a number. So meaning it's the number of protons, and there's no unit that goes with it. And then same thing for the mass number. It's just the number of protons and neutrons together, no kind of mass unit. Now, to know which isotope I'm talking about, I'd have to give you that information. I'd have to tell you how many neutrons, how many protons. So what I want to give you is some examples of some isotopes, which are 3 different forms of hydrogen. So notice they all have the same atomic number, the number that's on the bottom left, because that's automatically associated with which type of element that we have. And then we have 3 different mass numbers. So just to make sure that we're all following along, if we know that the atomic number is the number of protons, all of these are going to have 1 proton. But in the first isotope on the left, how many neutrons would there be? 0, right. And how did we get that? Well, if the mass number is the number of protons and neutrons, and I've already got my 1 proton, well, 1 minus 1 means there's 0 neutrons in that particular isotope. What about in the second isotope? How many neutrons do we have there? 1, okay. And then in the last isotope, 2. So the names for these isotopes are protium, deuterium, and tritium. Protium is by far the most common of the forms of hydrogen. It's roughly 99% or so of all hydrogen that's out there. Deuterium, a much smaller fraction, and tritium, only the tiniest fraction it naturally exists as tritium. Tritium, in fact, is radioactive. Deuterium shows up in certain kinds of applications. One place you might have heard of it before is in a substance known as heavy water, which is where you have water, H2O, but it's deuterium instead of hydrogen. A symbol sometimes used for deuterium is the capital letter D. It's a common enough form of hydrogen that it is sometimes given its own elemental symbol. So D2O is heavy water, which is sometimes used in building nuclear reactors. There's some other places where deuterium shows up, but it's a little too early in the quarter for me to tell you about those yet. So I want you to be familiar with the three forms of hydrogen, just so you know some examples of isotopes. And these are the isotopes that are mentioned in your chapter. So questions about atomic numbers or mass numbers? Then I want to start getting to some of the more difficult part of the chapter. The rest of the chapter is really trying to get at how are electrons arranged in atoms and how does that affect how the atoms are going to behave. So I got to give you a little bit of a backstory because I got to talk a little bit about light. And I want to talk about light just slightly beyond what may be in your textbook here. So hopefully at some point you'd learn that light is a wave. So if we have a wave, a sine wave, there are some properties of that wave that we could talk about. For example, if I start at one repetition of the wave, and I measure to how far that next repetition is, you know, one cycle of going all the way up and down. What do we call that distance between different repetitions of the wave? So frequency is related, but that's not the term I'm looking for. Amplitude we'll do in a second. That's another measurement of the wave. It's wavelength. The length it goes from one end of the cycle to the next. And that's usually represented with the Greek lowercase letter lambda. Wavelength would normally be measured in meters if we're talking about metric units. Sometimes it's listed in centimeters. Frequently, it's also measured in nanometers because visible light has wavelengths that are quite short. Now, amplitude, someone mentioned that. That would be the distance from the axis up to the tallest or the shallowest part of that wave. If it's a light wave, which we're talking about light, it's related to how bright that wave is. If it's a sound wave, then amplitude is related to how loud that sound is. Someone mentioned frequency, which let me define that over here. The frequency is the number of times that a wave oscillates in 1 second. If that's a little bit technical term, you could say how many cycles of that wave happen. So it's the number of cycles per second. So there's a unit of measure that goes with frequency, which is the hertz, abbreviated HZ, and that's equal to 1 per second, which means it's 1/seconds. Or if you have had physics and you've seen it this way, you could say seconds to the minus one. Now, you might have had some experience with hertz before, especially if you are international students. Because if you have electronic devices that you might have gotten in other countries and bring them to the U.S., there's two things that might be different between the way that those devices are built outside of the U.S. and within the U.S. One is the voltage, but the other is the frequency rating. So if you look at the back of most electronic devices, built in the U.S. at least, you'll see 60 hertz. Anyone have any idea why it's 60 hertz that it's set at? Anyone know what that's related to at all? But where does that come from? Yes, and that maybe that's why they chose 60, because it would give you one each, because it's related to the 60 seconds per minute. But it has to do with how power is generated. You know, ignoring wind power and solar and some of our new sustainable forms of energy, if we're talking about old school electrical generation, does anybody know how that's normally done? Yeah. Right. You've got this big, huge magnet that's turning around and around and around inside a coil of wires. And to simplify that explanation, as that magnet turns, it generates an electric current in that wire. But because that magnet is turning, and a magnet has a north end and a south end to it, it turns out that the electricity that's generated will oscillate just like this. It'll go from a positive voltage to a negative voltage, back and forth and back and forth. That's what's known as alternating current, AC power. So what comes out of our power plugs is exactly this. It's AC, alternating current, and the US, the frequency that's the standard, is 60 hertz. So for some of you, if you've listened to if you listen to music on some stereo systems and you get a background hum, either that's a cheap stereo system or it might be because of the power itself, that if it's got this signal that's got a particular frequency in it that can sometimes bleed into the sound that you get out of a stereo system. So I don't know if any of you know about how power is generated, but I just wanted to explain where in real life you might have encountered frequency before. Now, if wavelength is usually measured in meters and frequency, which is often abbreviated with a sort of fancy F, if we were to multiply wavelength and frequency together, then our units end up being meters over 1 second, or meters per second, which is the unit of measure of what? What else can we measure in terms of meters per second? Speed. These are the same units as speed. How far does something travel over a certain amount of time? The point is that light is a form of wave that has a fixed speed. You might have heard of the phrase speed of light before. And to simplify the whole discussion, that speed of light is a constant. So light has a constant speed, usually represented by lowercase c. So in light, frequency and wavelength are inversely proportional to each other. That means as frequency goes up, wavelength goes down. As frequency goes down, wavelength goes up. Now, a little more terminology, and then we'll get back to the story that's presented in the text here. Does anybody know what a spectrum is? Yes.
Color spectrum?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And do you know what the unit of measurement is, you could say, if you laid all those colors out? That's okay. It's either wavelength or frequency. What makes the different colors of light is exactly what frequency it has. Or since frequency and wavelength are related in light, you could always also say what wavelength does light have. So a spectrum is a range of wavelengths or frequencies. Of light. And let's say that we created an axis here. And let's say that I do things in terms of wavelength. Visible light is kind of special to us humans, so I'm going to put it right in the middle of the spectrum. And if these colors aren't showing well up on the overhead here, I'm trying to make a form of rainbow. So does anybody know on which end we have higher frequency or lower wavelength? Yes?
Red is lower frequency and violet is higher frequency.
That's right. So on the top of this, I'll say low frequency and high frequency, which on the bottom, that means long wavelength for low frequency and short wavelength for high frequency. To round the numbers off, just to make them easier to remember, which I'm not going to make you memorize these numbers, but just so you have some concept of what the numbers are. It's about 400 nanometers for the wavelength of blue or purple light, and somewhere approaching 700 nanometers for red light. So quite short wavelength, which means quite high frequency. So this is the range of the spectrum that you have visible light. Now what happens if we go just a little bit lower energy than red light? Does anybody know what we have there? Infrared, which is usually abbreviated IR. So infrared in practical life, if you have certain types of remote controls, you know, a lot of modern remote controls are Bluetooth or Wi-Fi based, but the older types of remotes, the simpler remotes, they just had lights on them, but they were in the IR range, so it wouldn't interfere with you watching a program. You wouldn't see lights going off when you use the remote. But whatever device that you have would have some kind of receptor, some kind of window that you'd aim the remote at, and it would use IR light to transmit that signal. What if you go to the other side of visible light? You go a little bit higher frequency, a little bit shorter wavelength than purple light. Ultraviolet, which is abbreviated UV. You may be familiar with the fact that too much exposure to UV light is bad for your skin, and that's because it's a higher energy, higher frequency form of light. Now, if you go back to this other side here, back beyond infrared, does anybody know what shows up beyond infrared? Microwaves, that's right. Just like in microwave ovens. What happens in microwave ovens? Well, that just happens to be the right frequency of light to excite water molecules to move around, which is why your things get heated up in a microwave oven. What about beyond microwaves even? You got radio waves. So if you've got 101 FM, oh gosh, now I've suddenly forgotten. I forget if it's, I think it's megahertz, which means those are pretty long wavelengths. Radio waves can be up to the range of 1 meter long or so. If you go to the other end of ultraviolet, what we got beyond there?
Just on radios, like, don't they use like crystals too to pick up the frequency, more or less?
Yes, so there's some kind of circuit inside a radio that attunes itself to these different frequencies. And not to get too technical, but there's two main types of radio signals out there. Frequency modulation, which is where you change very slightly the frequency, and then amplitude modulation, which is where you change the height of the wave.
Is there like a hybrid
between those two? I don't actually know. I know about AM and FM, but that's about where the extent of my knowledge of radios goes. But not a bad question to ask. Now, what about on the other side of ultraviolet light? We got gamma rays up at the top here. And we also got X-rays that are in between. Now, all of these different frequencies of light can be used for different purposes. So if any of you have ever had an MRI, then that is done with radio wave frequencies. Of course, X-rays, if any of you have ever been to the dentist or have had the misfortune to have broken bones, you know that X-rays are able to penetrate through skin, not as well through bone. That's why we can use X-rays to tell us something about bones. Visible ultraviolet infrared. Those are used in science to analyze materials. So you can come up with something about the structure of a substance using different forms of light. Okay, now that I've given you all this background info, now I can explain a little bit about what the chapter gets into. Because just to flash the picture of what's in your text here, you're shown what's called a continuous spectrum. So that's why I wanted to take a little bit of time to explain what a spectrum is. But you're also shown these things that are called emission spectra. And the big difference here is that on a continuous spectrum, you can see every frequency of light. But on these emission spectra for different elements, there's only very specific colors of light that come out. And that's what's going to lead us to our discussion about atomic theory. Because it was observed that if you took specific elements and you excited them, zapped them with electricity, you could cause them to give out these different frequencies of light, but only specific frequencies of light. And that's what's led to what's known as the Bohr model of the atom. And let me just explain what that Bohr model is. Because around the early 1900s, these experiments were done to show that different substances only give off specific frequencies of light. So then the question came up, well, why doesn't just any form of light get released by any substance? And here's the idea that was thought up. What if electrons are circling around the nucleus, but in specific pathways? Think of them like planets revolving around the sun. And what can happen is that if you add energy to an electron, that electron can be bumped up to another energy level. Well, what goes up has to come back down again. So once you excite electrons by maybe zapping them with electricity, then when they fall back down again, they're going to release a specific amount of light. And if electrons only travel in these very specific paths, then that's why only specific amounts or specific kinds of light gets released. So the Bohr model of the atom comes from the observation that when atoms are excited, they only give off specific frequencies of light. And this was thought to be due to electrons moving between specific energy levels. Question.
Is this how neon lights work?
Yes. The question was asked, is this how neon lights work? Yes. That you have a gas that's being zapped by electricity. That gas, once excited, those electrons fall back down again, and they only release a very specific color, which, depending on the, not to get too technical, but which gas you put in the tube, or sometimes if you put a specific coating around the tube, you can change what frequency of light you get, which means you can change what color that you get.
So let me see. What was I saying here? The Bohr model assumes that light only comes off in specific frequencies, and this was thought to be due to electrons moving between specific energy levels. And once this idea came up, then they started exploring the different elements on the periodic table. And they started to come up with this relationship that there was a certain maximum number of electrons that could occupy each energy level. But then came the question of, why is it do electrons only have specific energy levels? Because let's say that you have an object traveling around in a circle. If you add just a little bit more energy to it, you think it should be able to move just a little bit further away from that center of the circle. Or if it loses some energy, then you can imagine like a planet that's lost energy might eventually crash into the sun. So you would think, if that was true, that an electron should be able to be anywhere around an atom and should be able to absorb and release any amount of energy that it wants to. And this is where the story gets complicated, and this is where I'm going to stop writing down for just a moment. Because around the early 1900s, there was a huge revolution in physics, a huge revolution in the way that the whole world was viewed. Because prior to that, we have things like electrons, protons, neutrons, matter, that we think of as particles. And then we have this stuff, light, that was thought of as a wave. Very simply, there are experiments that can be done to show that light acts like a wave. You can get two waves that if they're traveling exactly at the same frequency as each other, if they start exactly at the same point, they can add together to make a more powerful wave. But it also can happen that if you have two waves that are exactly matched opposite of each other, that one reaches its peak as the other reaches its bottom point, well, if you put those two waves together, they can cancel each other out. Which, that's exactly how noise cancellation headphones work. Do you all know how noise cancellation headphones work, you all that have them? So what happens is that the headphones themselves have a microphone on them so that they're listening to the outside world. Some of that sound's going to pass through the insulation on the headphones. But what the headphones do then is they take the signal from the outside world and turn it upside down. So that whatever sound is making it through, if it's zigging while this other way zags, if the real sound wave is going up while this signal that the headphones is sending out is going down, well, then the two waves cancel each other. Sound waves are nothing more than air being moved back and forth. So if one wave is pushing the air one direction at the same time the other wave is pushing air the other direction, it's like the air never moves, which means it cancels out the sound. That's what noise cancellation headphones are. And these same kind of cancellation experiments can be done with light to show that light acts like a wave. And then came the early 1900s, where the picture got more complicated. Have you ever heard of a photon before, besides photon torpedoes in science fiction? So a photon is a particle of light, which that brings up the question, well, how can you have a particle light if it acts like a wave? Well, that's because it actually ends up acting like both. We can do experiments that show that light acts like a particle, even though we can do other experiments that show that light acts like a wave. And so here's what happened in the early 1900s. Once they came up with that idea, they said, okay, well, if electrons act like particles,
could electrons act like waves as well? And the answer ends up being yes. Well, how does that at all explain what's going on in the atom here? Well, I'm going to try to give you a little bit of an explanation. But in order to do it, I need to do a bit of a demonstration. And in order to do that, I need someone to volunteer. Which, just so you know what you're getting yourself into, all you're going to have to do is hold this coil of tubing still for me. So if you could just hold that still and try to keep the roll from turning. Actually, could you let a little bit more go for me here? Perfect, right there. Okay. So imagine this is like the string on a musical instrument. What happens if I start moving this thing up and down? It's just kind of randomly wiggling, isn't it? No real good pattern to it. Until I reach some kind of minimal amount of energy, and it's like this wave takes on a life of its own. And you can see that wave, it's got two endpoints to it. It's got where I'm holding it and where she's holding it. If I slow down a little bit, the wave starts disappearing and goes random again. If I go back up to that minimum amount of energy, then the wave appears. What if I go faster? The wave's just going to wiggle faster, right? No, if I go faster, the wave disappears again. The simplification of that physics is that the wave is interfering with itself. As it looks like it's bouncing straight up and down, that's actually because of waves traveling back and forth. But look what happens if I get it going fast enough. All of a sudden, I get the second wave in there, which, since you all got your digital devices, if you were to take a picture of this in slow-mo, you would see that one half of the wave is pointed down, while the other half of the wave is pointed up. How you doing there? Is that tough to hold on to? Okay, all right. So if I slow down a little bit again, this wave totally falls apart until I get slow enough where now that first or principal wave comes back. So in other words, if I add the right amount of energy, but only the right amount of energy, I can generate this second wave. Of course, if I add the right amount of energy, I can get a wave that's cut into three parts here. And again, if I could do this perfectly, there's these places in the center here where the wave would not be moving. But again, if I slow down, you can get it where the wave is cut in half, or if I slow down, you can get it where the wave is going straight across. But there's no point where it's like 2.5 wiggles in between. There's only these specific amounts of energy, which you could call those energy levels. Thank you. Got it. Let me put on paper what I just demonstrated. And I know a lot of this is outside of the text, but I don't like teaching just what is something and you have no idea what it is. I'd rather you have a little bit of an idea of what's going on. The same kind of thing happens in strings, like I said, in a musical instrument. If you play violin and guitar or some form of musical instrument and you pluck that string, why does that make that particular note? Because you've got a wave that's vibrating between the two endpoints, and it's got a frequency to it that depends on how long is that string, how tense is the string, what kind of material is it made out of. That's right. And if you take your finger and very lightly put it exactly in the middle of that string, you get what's called a harmonic, which is the next highest frequency wave. Because if you cut the string exactly in half, then you can generate another wave where the endpoints will still match. Yes? Am I? Well, no. I don't play guitar. I actually play sitar.
Oh, even better. Well, it's like a much more complicated instrument.
Yes. So maybe at some point, if we get it with the time, I could do a demo. But back to this, you can also generate other notes, as you might be familiar with as well, if you know where along the string to touch. The point is that a string can have all these different waves to it, but as long as the endpoints of the wave match. Because if you tried to generate a wave where the wave doesn't match the endpoints, well, that wave just can't exist. And that's what was going on in the demonstration up here. When I wiggled it with enough energy, I was able to get this first wave going. Above that energy, below that energy a little bit, it didn't work, because the wave that I was trying to make didn't match those endpoints. If I added enough energy to it, then you were able to get this wave that cut this in half or in thirds. So here's the point. Electrons act like waves. Electrons act like waves just like this, but trapped around a nucleus. And that means that electrons can only have specific amounts of energy to them because they're acting like waves. It's what explains why there ends up being only these specific energy levels. So the Bohr model, which is what the book talks about, is the fact that electrons can only exist at these very specific levels. The explanation behind it is that electrons act like waves, what are specifically known as standing waves. That's not where you're just doing this. There's two types of waves. There's a light wave, which once you shoot it out, it propagates. It goes somewhere. That's known as a propagating wave. You make a sound like that, the disturbance in the air fills out through the room. That's a moving or propagating wave. But if you have something that's got fixed endpoints to it, you can have a wave that vibrates just between those two endpoints. And that's what an electron does around an atom. So electrons act both as particles and waves. You can count out a certain number of electrons, but that electron will also have some wave behavior to it. It's what is known as the wave-particle duality, and it's one of the most complicated concepts in all of chemistry. So because electrons act like what are known as standing waves, they can only have specific amounts of energy, which your book uses the term quanta. Quantum is the singular. So that's what a quantum is. It's a certain packet, a certain amount of energy. Electrons can only have specific quantities of energy, which is why electrons exist in specific energy levels. This is why, when atoms or molecules are excited, electrons only travel between specific energy levels, which is why only specific frequencies of light are released. What I'd like to try to do now is to explain to you a bit about electron configurations. So, first concept is this. That Bohr model of the atom, where you have the nice planetary orbits, is totally not what electrons do inside the atom. Because those orbits make it seem like those are particles traveling around in fixed pathways. Electrons act like waves, so the picture is a bit more complicated. And what you have instead of orbits, the word we use instead is orbital. that was a word created to describe this thing that the electron does. So an orbital is a specific region in space that an electron can exist in. And the orbitals have different shapes to them. The simplest type of shape is one that looks just like a sphere. The next type of shape is one that looks like a dumbbell. If you imagine that wave demonstration I showed you earlier, remember that that lowest energy wave was undivided as it went from one end point to another. The next energy level up, that wave was cut in half. That's similar to what's going on here, that one of the simplest orbitals, which we call an S orbital, has no division to it. If you to take an orbital that's a higher energy, then it gets cut in half. That happens to be called a P orbital. It's not shown in your textbook, but if you go up another bit of energy, then you create what's called a D orbital, which has two cuts through it. So that's just to show you examples of what the shapes of orbitals look like. The part that is really hard to understand is that the electrons don't follow fixed paths. They have a probability of being found somewhere within this space. Since I've already talked enough outside the text today, I'd like to just leave that concept alone for the moment. And then if we get time next time, then I could talk more about it. But for right now, we'll just know that an orbital is a region where electrons can exist in. So there's three layers of structure that we can talk about inside of the atom. The part that does match the Bohr model somewhat is there are these fixed energy levels. And so the term used to describe that is a shell. So a shell is an energy level inside an atom. Inside of that, you have what's called a subshell. So a subshell is a set of orbitals that are the same type inside an energy level. So it's a set of orbitals, all of the same type, which means S, P, or D, inside an energy level. And then you have an orbital itself. And a little bit more about an orbital is it can hold a maximum of 2 electrons. So I'm going to do a type of block diagram to tell you how electrons end up occupying the first few energy levels. So this is not the way that the book shows it, but I'm just trying to help make a little more sense. So the way that we refer to a particular energy level is the number N. So if I say N equals 1, you have the first energy level. For reasons that we're not going to get into right now, the first subshell is, well, there's only one subshell inside the first energy level, and it's the S subshell, the S being a particular type of orbital, or a particular shape of orbital. And inside that subshell, there's one orbital. So this line is representing an orbital. and it can have a maximum of 2 electrons in it. The next energy level would be N equals 2. And these are the shells. Because there's this extra amount of energy, it's a higher energy level, now there are 2 types of subshells that we can have. An S subshell and a P subshell. The S subshell has 1 orbital. The P subshell has 3. Again, to not totally overload you, I'll tell you a little bit more of the why later on. Right now, I'm just trying to get some of the what out there so I can match what's going on in the textbook. Instead of these box symbols, there's a simpler way to represent where an electron is located. And so I can use a symbol like this. 1s2. The 1 represents the shell, which is the same thing as the energy level. The S tells you which type of orbital is, and so that's the type of subshell that it's in. And then the number up above is how many electrons in that subshell. And there is a pattern that develops. In the S, you can have a total of 2 electrons. In the P, you can have a total of 6. I'll do one more energy level just to show how the pattern continues. And even though I'm big on why, believe me, it's a long explanation. So we're going to get to some of the why in this case a little bit later on. So in the third shell, now that you've got extra energy, there's one more subshell that can exist. You've got the S subshell. You've got the P subshell. And then the D. That's why I wanted to draw a picture of a D orbital. So there's 1 orbital that can be in the S, there's 3 of them that can be in the P, and there's 5 of them that can be in the D. So the pattern keeps on continuing. The next energy level down, you have another type of orbital, and there can be 7 of them. The next energy level, you have another type of orbital, and there can be 9 of them. So it goes 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, like that. So here's 1, 3, 5. So that means in an S subshell, you can have 2 electrons. In a P subshell, you can have 6. And in a D subshell, you can have 10. And there's an order that these electrons tend to go in. So the order of subshells goes like this. 1s, 2s, 2p, just like what's shown here in the diagram. 3s, 3p, and then the pattern gets a little bit out of order. And I'll tell you the story of why it gets out of order next time. There is a way to remember what the order is, which let me just show you that diagram in the textbook. So if you start out with the ones, all the S's, and you put them in a row, and then you start on the next level up, and then you start with the P's, and then the D's, and then the F's. F is the name of the next one. this diagonal way of tracing lines just happens to give you the right order. But this is kind of a complicated way of remembering things. I prefer to use the periodic table. Because if you look at the periodic table, look at the first row of the periodic table. How many elements do we have there? Just two, right? Hydrogen on the left, helium on the right. I said earlier that a neutral atom has the same number of electrons like you have protons. So hydrogen is atomic number one, and so neutral hydrogen would have one electron in it. Then helium's got two protons, so neutral helium would have two electrons in it. Well, this first shell can only hold two electrons. So the next electron that might want to go in has to go to a new energy level, which matches the fact that we go to a new row on the periodic table. And so we have lithium and beryllium. Notice that those two are all by themselves on the left, because that matches this S subshell getting filled up. Then if you count, how many elements are on the right-hand side from B, boron, going over to Ne, neon? How many elements are in that part of the periodic table? Six. It matches the fact that you can stuff six electrons into the P subshell. And then once you're done with that, you have to go to the next energy level, which if you look at back at the periodic table, after neon, we go to the next row. So the short version is each row on the periodic table represents a new shell. But then what happens is you start going higher and higher in energy, the different cells and she sells seashells by the seashore. The different shells and subshells start ending getting mixed up with each other. And there is an explanation I can give later why the order gets out of order. But we could use the periodic table to figure out what that order is. And here's how we do it. These different blocks, these different regions of the periodic table have names that go with them. So the first two columns are called the S block. The last six columns are called the P block. Now, if you look here at this D subshell, how many electrons did I say could fit in the D subshell?
10.
If you look at the periodic table, on the one that's in our classroom, below the words periodic table of the elements, straight down below, you have SC, which is scandium, going across. Scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, zinc, copper, zinc. How many columns are there in that part of the table? 10. It matches this D subshell. That's why this is called the D block on the periodic table. So what you do is you look at the beginning of the periodic table. You know that you're in the first energy level. There's only the S subshell. Question, sorry. We'll get there. That's what he's referring to is what's known as the F block that's down here below the periodic table. In this level class, we're probably never going to get to doing the configurations for those elements because it gets more complicated than it's needed for this class. But to answer your question, that's where those are located, the F block. Now, I should say, why is helium located on the right-hand side of the periodic table if there's no such thing as a P subshell in the first energy level? In this case, it's because of how helium behaves. It behaves just like the other elements below it that normally don't react. More appropriately, helium should be right next to hydrogen, right above Be, beryllium, because helium is part of the S block of elements. So in the first row, all you really have is the S block. Then you go to the next row, and you start over again with the S block. That's why it goes 1S, 2s. Once you run out of these s orbitals, these s elements, then you go over to the p block, 2p. You get to the end of the row, you start over again. Then you're in 3s and 3p. You get to the end of the row, you start over again. And then you get 4s. And then it gets a little bit more complicated. You get 3d. I will tell you, for the purpose of the quiz, the highest element that you're going to have to worry about right now is argon, number 18. Now, there's a reason I want you to know about these S blocks and P blocks, and that's what I'm going to try to explain the rest of the time I've got left today. So first, let's get to the practical. Let me write out some electron configurations. So an electron configuration is a list of where electrons are located. In other words, which orbitals are they located in? And so for hydrogen, there is only one electron, and it goes into that lowest energy orbital. Now, the connected with this is the concept of what's known as the ground state. So that is the lowest possible energy configuration for an atom. Because earlier I was talking about zapping elements, having their electrons jump up in energy and fall back down again. Well, when they fall back down as far as they can, back down to their lowest energy, that's what's called the ground state, like you're standing here on the ground. So hydrogen only has one electron, so it goes in the lowest energy shell, which is the one. In that first energy level, you only have s orbitals. And there's only one electron there, so we have the label 1s1. Add one more proton to get to helium, then it's going to have one more electron with it. So now we get to 1s2. You can only have two electrons in an s subshell. So if we go to the next element, lithium, you got to go up to the next possible spot. And that's in the 2s subshell. We only have three electrons total, so this is going to have a configuration of 1s2, 2s1. Beryllium has one more electron that can go and fill up that s subshell in the n equals 2 level. Now, if you look back at this box diagram that I had earlier, here's the 1s subshell. Let me add some labels to this. So this is the 1s. This is the 2s. This is the 2p. And you can see we can squeeze up to 6 electrons in that p subshell. So after beryllium, then we got everything on the right-hand side of the periodic table. Boron, 1s2, 2s2, 2p1. Carbon, 1s2, 2s2, 2p2. Nitrogen, 1s2, 2s2, 2p3. Keeps on going as we go to oxygen and then fluorine. And then neon. That is the end of the 2 shell. When you fill up the S subshell and the P subshell, we're done. Now, how many electrons do we have just in that outer shell? 8. So if you've had some chemistry before, you might have heard of the octet rule. Well, the octet rule is this.
that an atom is unusually stable if it has 8 electrons in its outer shell. There's a term for that outer shell that's known as the valence shell. So there are valence electrons. Those are electrons in the outermost shell. Now, why do we care about valence electrons? Well, if they're in the outer shell, those are the higher energy electrons, and so those are the ones that will participate in chemical reactions. So there are electrons in the outermost shell, and they're the highest energy electrons. That will participate in chemical reactions. Okay, now let's go back over to some more electron configurations, because we go to the next row on the periodic table. We've got sodium, 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. We're out of the space in twos, so we have to go to the 3 energy level. And the first subshell we get to is always the S subshell. How can I recognize that? Well, look where the sodium, Na, is on the periodic table. Third row, it's in that set of 2 columns, which is what I call the S block. That's a way of remembering it's the S electrons that get filled up first. And no matter which row you're on, there can only be up to 2 electrons in an S subshell. Then that means as we keep going, we got aluminum, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon. That's going to start filling up the 3P subshell. So you notice that the configuration, the first part, it's always the same as we keep going down the periodic table. So that's why I'm filling in all these 1s2s, 2p2s, or 1s2s, 2s2, 2p6s. Because all we're doing is adding to that last shell. So silicon is ends in 3p2, phosphorus ends in 3p3. Sulfur 3p4, chlorine 3p5, and argon 3p6. But notice that argon has an octet, just like neon has an octet. And that's why we have the periodic table. Elements that have the same valence configuration behave in chemically the same way. Let me write that statement out. Elements with the same valence shell configuration, which means the same number of valence electrons, chemically behave the same way. So in fact, all of these elements that are in the last column, helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, radon, they all mostly don't react, because they all have octet configurations. And you might say, well, wait, how do you have only 8 electrons on the outside if you've got all this stuff in the middle of the periodic table? So that's because the d electrons, when they come in, they're always one energy level behind. Whether you want to use the periodic table or whether you want to use this cheat sheet that's in the textbook, if you look at the order, it goes 1s, 2, or 1s, 2s, 2p, 3s, 3p, 4s, 3d, then 4p. So you'll always have s and p following right after each other. Means you'll always have on the outer shell the possibility of getting 8 electrons, which is why we have this octet rule. Now, I said for the quiz, I'm not going to go past argon. And you don't have to memorize these electron configurations if you can remember this pattern that I showed you. So one more time, if I can look at the picture of the periodic table I had drawn. One second, let me find where I put it. We start with the S block, which for helium and hydrogen, they're up above the rest of the table. So you have 1s, then you have 2s, 2p, 3s, 3p. That's the order of the first part of the periodic table. That's the part that's easier to eventually understand or memorize. And so if you can follow that, and if you can remember that S's can only have 2, P's can only have a maximum of 6, then you'll be able to come up with these configurations. Now, let me talk a little bit more about the periodic table, because that's where the end of the chapter gets into. It gets into these families of elements. And just to show you, your textbook uses the same kind of designation. Notice that it calls these first 2 columns the S columns. It uses these last 6 columns and calls them the P. The transition metals, which are transitioning between these 2 main parts of the table, they're all the D electrons, and then you have F electrons that typically are drawn below the periodic table. Why are they drawn below? Well, because if you did it the way it's shown here, you end up with a super wide periodic table, which in terms of printing it out, makes it trickier to do. So usually they take these F elements and put them down below instead. So I'm just showing you this to show that a lot of what I'm talking about now really is in the text, which is why I'd wondered if you all started reading it, because you're probably looking at this and going, holy crap, do I have to know all this? Well, you have to know some of it, which is what I'm going to review here in just a minute. So here is the point. Again, drawing this picture of the periodic table. And dividing it up. If you follow all the electron configurations, then no matter what row you're on, with only a few exceptions, which we won't even get into in this class, the first column always ends in S1. The second column always ends in S2. The third is always S2P1, then S2P2, S2P3, S2P4, S2P5, and the last one's always S2P6. I just said that elements with the same valence configuration chemically behave the same way. And so everything that's in one column is all going to have the same kind of behavior. Now, if you're over here at the last column, if you're an octet, then that means you don't really want to gain or lose any electrons. And so those elements tend to exist just as they are, unreacted. But if you've only got 7 electrons, then what would you want to do to become an octet? You'd want to gain an electron, wouldn't you? So in a chemical reaction, those elements are going to react to become -1 charged, because that gets you to an octet. And so if you look at fluorine, chlorine, bromine, iodine, when they form compounds, those are substances made up of more than one element, well, they want to normally gain electrons. So that's why they end up -1 charged. The other side of the periodic table, if you've only got 1 electron in your outer shell, if you want to get to an octet, you got 2 choices. You can gain 7 electrons, but if you end up with something that's -7 charge, you have all these negative charges fighting each other. So it'd be easier just to lose that 1 electron. If you lose that 1 electron, that means you end up with a positive charge, which is what sodium and potassium and all those elements want to do. So when you have a substance like sodium chloride, table salt, the sodium ends up +1, the chlorine ends up -1, which is why the two stick together to make sodium chloride. The same pattern shows up in these other families, where the second column, S2, they like to lose 2. S2P1, it's easier to lose 3 than to gain 5. And so these are the charges that those elements tend to form. So the last bit of terminology I'm going to give you is that these are known as groups. So group is a set of elements. In the same column of the periodic table. And again, if they all have the same valence configuration, then they're all going to behave just like each other. So that's why in sea water, it's not just sodium chloride we find, but sodium bromide and sodium iodide. They all form very similar compounds because they're elements in the same family, the same group of the periodic table. Now, there's bits of this chapter we didn't get to because I tried to explain a little bit beyond the text. But now I have to wrap up and say what's going to be on the quiz. So in terms of types of questions, we don't have a heck of a lot of theory yet. So quiz number 1 is going to be pretty heavy on definitions, especially on the material from chapter 1 and 2. Now, there are some numerical problems that you're going to get too. And just to mention 2 of them before we go back and cover the topics. One is the concept of a mole. So you remember that we did some calculation of how many moles do we have of a particular substance, which means you come up with a molar mass. It's where we use unit conversion factors. I told you you wouldn't have to memorize any of the unit conversion factors for feet or inches, but you do need to be able to handle unit conversion factors. So maybe I'll put in parentheses here, moles and unit conversions. Those would be 2 types of small types of calculation problems. As I said, we don't really have much in the way of theory yet, except for Why do atoms only release specific colors of light? The answer to that question would be electrons can only exist in specific energy levels, so electrons can only release specific types of light. It's a very short answer, but that would be the type of theory question I could ask. So you have definitions, you have some small amount of calculation, and then you might have a couple of simpler theory problems. Yes? That's what I'm going to write now, as far as the material. So chapter one, we didn't hit all the sections, so that's what I'm going to go back and confirm for you. We totally skipped over sections 1 and 2, I know, and we really didn't pick up until section 5. So chapter 1, it'll be sections 5, where we talked about physical versus, oh, actually, we didn't get to that. We talked about mass versus weight. We talked about actually, that's all we talked about in section 5. So I'll tell you this. The general rule is if I talked about it in class, it's something that's on the quiz. If we didn't get to it yet, it's not on the quiz.
So when you read section 5, I did talk about weight versus mass, but I didn't
talk about chemical versus physical properties. So that means chemical versus physical properties is not on the quiz. That'll be something I have to pick up back before the exam.
So then we move on to section 6, which was where we talked about elements, mixtures, compounds, molecules, chemical symbols, atoms, all that terminology. Section 7, which is where you got the metric system with your types of units and then the metric prefixes. Section 7 also has unit conversions. Section 8 had a discussion of density, which we've talked about.
We also talked about intensive versus extensive properties.
And Chapter 9 was on energy and on temperature scales.
So it's going to be sections 5 through 9 for Chapter 1. For Chapter 2,
I think we hit all of the sections, but let me just double check. Section 1 was
the fact that the word atom comes from an ancient Greek concept.
Section 2 is where we had the laws of conservation of mass,
the law of definite proportion.
Section 3, we had atomic theory and the law of multiple proportions. Section 4 is where we did get into the mole. And section 5 is where we briefly talked about the periodic table. So we did talk about sections 5. And section 6
is where it gets to the definition of a molecule. So it is sections 1 through 6. But remember, if we didn't talk about something specific in class, like we didn't talk about Lavoisier, then that's not going to be on the quiz. Now, what about this chapter that we just got to?
So we skipped over sections 1 through 4. Well, no.
Section 4 we did talk about. That was the gold foil experiment. So another small theory-type question might be, how did the gold foil experiment demonstrate that the atom has a nucleus? And that's where you would explain that these positively charged helium particles, these positively charged alpha particles, bounced off of the atoms. So they bounced off of some core that was positively charged, and that's where the idea of the nucleus came from.
So section 5 has mass numbers and atomic numbers and isotopes. Section 6 is where it talks about the Bohr model and the fact that atoms only give off or absorb specific types of light. Section 7 is where it gets to electron configurations. And Section 8 is where it gets to valence electrons and the periodic table. But we didn't talk about metals or nonmetals. We didn't talk about the names of the groups. We didn't talk about transition elements.
So remember, any terminology I didn't touch on yet is not on the quiz.